Welcome to Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, Gerard Shurin, award-winning anthologist and editor of The Big Book of Cyberpunk, is joined by two of the book's contributing writers, Lauren Bukes and E.J. Swift. Our panel examine the role speculative fiction can play as we reimagine the world around us and how cyberpunk can help us shape the world of tomorrow. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, explore the genre of cyberpunk, its imaginative storytelling, and its predictions of virtual reality, cybernetics, and AI.
Hi, my name is Jared. I will be your moderator for the next hour, and I am responsible, or at least as responsible as the editor is, which is not really all that responsible, of The Big Book of Cyberpunk. This is one of two volumes, both of which are out there. Tiny bit of housekeeping before I introduce my companions on stage. The first is, I am going to be looking at my phone, because that's where my questions are, because I'm so 2024. I will not be checking the England score. If anyone is first, that's totally fine. I don't blame you. That's great. Secondly, right hand for England goal, left hand for Slovakia. If you could just do that, that would be absolutely brilliant. And I would appreciate it very much. But thank you unbelievably much for coming out. It's a lovely Sunday. There's lots going on. And we're all very tickled that you've chosen to spend your time with us. So without further ado, the more interesting members of the panel. So I'm going to start with Emma. E.J. Swift, if you would talk a tiny bit about it yourself.
So I'm E.J. Swift. I'm a science fiction novelist and short story writer. A lot of my work focuses on climate change and environmental issues. And my most recent novel was The Coral Bones, which was published in 2022 originally. And that one focuses on the Great Barrier Reef and what's happening with the corals out there.
And was also shortlisted for the Arthur C. Clarke Award.
Oh, thank you. It was.
I'm Lauren Bukes. I wrote a novel called The Shiny Girls, which is now an Apple TV show with Elizabeth Moss and Jamie Bell, which is very exciting. I write kind of high-concept literary thrillers, but my first novel was a short story, which was cyberpunk, So I feel like deep in my bones, that's kind of a deep connection. And my new novel is Bridge. It's about a mother who has died and left behind a legacy for her daughter, which is an artifact which allows you to switch realities. And maybe in one of those other realities, Bridge's mom is alive and she can get the answers that she was looking for.
Have you ever been up for the Arthur C. Clarke Award?
I have won the Arthur C. Clarke Award.
So I should probably warn you that Lauren, Emma, and I also go sort of way back. If you were expecting a very serious discussion of these topical issues facing us, I'm really sorry. But there is also a productivity panel going on down the street, apparently, which is really useful.
At what point can I get that picture on my phone?
You may not put any of the pictures on the phone up there. I also realize, and this just occurred to me, although Emma and Lauren are both in The Big Book of Cyberpunk, they are actually in different volumes.
So you're going to have to buy both.
Yes. So I'm incredibly sorry. This is either going to be very competitive or very expensive if you do want to buy books to be signed afterwards. I was hoping you could tell us a tiny bit about your stories before we go there. Lauren, would you mind telling us a little bit about Branded?
Branded is very much inspired by Naomi Klein, not Naomi Wolf, but also just about like Branded Society, and it's about a guy who's a video blogger. I wrote the story in, like, I guess 2004, and he goes to a pool game, and there's a young woman there who's a sponsor baby, and what's happened is that they've injected nanotechnology into her, which makes her literally addicted to a soft drink. It was also, unfortunately, I realized when I wrote the novel, and then I did the introduction for Jeff Noon's Vert, which is an incredible cyberpunk novel, and when I reread Vert for the first time in 20 years, I was like, oh my God, Moxieland's basically Vert fan fiction. That kind of became my first novel, and it was a really interesting way of looking at kind of artists being co-opted by big brands, and I'd done research on there were lucky strike parties happening in Cape Town at the time. Cigarette advertising became illegal, and this was part of the inspiration. So they started having these underground parties, but they were brand specific. So Peter Stuyvesant was all about like the beach lifestyle and like models on a yacht. And Lucky Strike were like, we're doing secret underground concerts. And you had to see the Lucky Strike brand sign in a bar and see the phone number and text that number. And they spent like R1 million on this train rave, which then took you to a beach where Carl Cox was playing. And they flew out like Bush and I can't remember the other bands, but like massive bands for these secret concerts. And that was also kind of really interesting to kind of play with and to look at how, as artists, we're constantly being co-opted by capitalism.
And I think it's really interesting because you, I mean, 2004 was, I think, which is amazing. First, you were writing at age 3, which is incredible. But secondly, that sort of, it predates modern influencer culture. Can you talk a little bit about like what inspired that sort of thinking that, you know, people were going to be becoming brand ambassadors in that way as individuals?
I guess all science fiction writers are looking at what's happening currently, and you're taking a thread and you're pulling on it and seeing where it goes. What was really interesting was I recently did a talk with the American School in Cape Town about Moxieland, which was the novel which Brandon became, and I'd forgotten there was a pandemic in it. In 2018, there's a huge pandemic, and I'm like, oh, what? But yeah, so I was kind of looking at what was happening in the real world. I hadn't really thought, I mean, it has been interesting. There's a lot of stuff I wish I'd frickin' patented and kind of made a fortune off, because there was a lot of stuff in Moxieland which was very, like, on point, on brand.
It was sort of, I mean, that's even before, to a certain degree, the sort of social media boom. But to think about that sort of level of brand influence before it became, sadly, our everyday lives.
Absolutely.
Emma, could you tell us a little bit about Alligator Heap?
Yeah, so Alligator Heap, it was quite an interesting one because this story was actually commissioned as part of an IP project. So I was kind of given a very baseline world to work from, which was essentially a stratified society of sort of 3 tiers, very much literally represented in a kind of architecture of 3 tiers. And so that was the landscape I was given to work in. And there was a sort of 3 or 4 other writers and then 3 or 4 academics writing on ideas of the future as well. And I was given food, which was quite an interesting one, because it's not something I naturally would have necessarily gone towards, even though being an avid MasterChef fan, I was very happy to talk about food. But yeah, my character is, one of the characters in it is one of the sort of richest members of society. He's a very famous chef. He's 110 years old, but he's been given the chance to get a new body. And the story is really kind of exploring his relationship with this body that's waiting for him to basically take the decision of uploading his consciousness and getting the new body. But he's sort of like, well, what happens if I don't like food in this new body? What's it going to be like? So, yeah, it was kind of, that was the inspiration. It was quite an interesting one, but yeah.
I mean, it's a brilliant story about, as you say, I mean, it's about consumption on literally every level. I mean, it's interesting because in a weird way, your inspiration was sort of handed to you. Emma, go write food. But how do you then go about, where did you start digging from there? Or was it all just wild creative extrapolation?
I love sort of seeing food as artistry and that sort of concept and what people come up with and that side of things. And I was sort of thinking, well, how would you push the boundaries if you were in a slightly more futuristic sort of environment? So I was interested in that, and also how this person had made his money, which is looking at what foods we might need to start, you know, using to replace foods that might fail in the near future because of crops being all the same. So, for instance, the character makes a lot of money out of teff, which is an Ethiopian grain, and that sort of creates the foundations of his empire. So there was little things like that in there. And then I also had fun with the kind of 3 tiers. His nurse is from the sort of middle tier, and that was kind of playing around on a lot of issues around like job precarity and that kind of thing. And at the very bottom, you have the trash heap, which was patrolled by alligators, and that was just a kind of fun thing that I like to play on. And the nurse is telling this old man stories of the people who are still believed to lurk somewhere on the surface, and maybe they've mutated a bit, no one's quite sure, but they're living around this trash heap. So yeah, I quite like having a little prompt sometimes. I find that quite a good way for short stories, especially to sort of give yourself something to jump off.
I think especially like when it's something that's kind of outside of what you would normally write about. One of my favorite stories is The Green, and I had to write about like, you know, mecha, so like giant robots. And I was like, oh, what am I going to do with this? But actually, I wrote a really interesting story, and I love having a prompt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've talked a little bit about how branded became sort of inadvertently predictive, and apparently we should blame you for the pandemic, so thanks for that. Almost being spurred to predict, and that's a huge part of the panel description as well, but around the idea of science fiction as a fiction of prediction. You know, we know of it as future-facing, as sort of imaginative and extrapolation, but there's almost a responsibility there, that if you're going to be writing around the future, that you need to be predictive in some way. And is that important? Do you take that into consideration? That, you know, how seriously do you have to take the predictive elements of your work when you set out to them? Lauren, I'm going to start with you, especially because, you know, Bridge is wild. Like, I don't think the technology there is going to happen.
No, it's not.
Do you feel an obligation to explain it or to create a path to it or anything like that?
My novel Before Bridge was, of course, a pandemic novel, which came out in the middle of the pandemic. That was great. And what was really irritating was, so it came out in July 2020, and there was a South African reviewer who emailed me questions, and he was like, did you write this whole thing in the last 3 months? I'm like, oh, sweet child, no, that is not how publishing works. And people were like, oh, like, how did you get this right? Like, it's so amazing. Like, you know, you've got a scene where, like, the airport is sold out of hand sanitizer. I'm like, because I did my research. What? Like, you know, that's actually, you know, if you've watched Contagion, like, you know, if you just do research, like, that is what would happen. I don't worry too much about, like, whether things are absolutely going to happen. It's kind of just kind of playing with ideas. And I think science fiction as a genre in particular is really about who we are right now. And when you're extrapolating, when you're playing on, you are pulling on those threads, but you're also looking at leaps in technology, and in Bridge, it's completely impossible technology. It's a world where you can Freaky Friday across alternate realities and swap with your other version of yourself, who, of course, is very shocked and horrified to suddenly find themselves in your place. Lots of issues of consent, which is also interesting to play with. So I don't think that's ever going to be something which happens. But, you know, like, you write genre because you're trying to put your characters in interesting situations to explore big ideas, you know, around who we are and who we choose to be. Or, you know, in Moxieland, it's like how there's a whole activist strand there. And I was kind of looking at political activism. I was very much inspired by growing up under apartheid and reading things like 2000 AD. You know, so we had sanctions in South Africa, which meant that American comics came in very sporadically. You know, so I would get Amethyst issue 12 and then Amethyst issue 34. And I'm like, I don't know what happened in between. I've got to, like, try and figure it out. But 2000 AD Monthly came in monthly. And I was so inspired by the way it used, you know, like Johnny Alpha, who's this mutant who's treated really badly, and of course the X-Men are also treated really badly, is an allegory for apartheid. You know, this fascist police state where the police, what they say goes, and to use genre as a way of political commentary was really interesting to me, which was, of course, also happening in South African theater because we had an intense censorship board, and people would use allegory or fantasy or magic as a way of kind of talking about oppression. So it's always been kind of deep-baked into me. Does anyone remember the TV show V about the aliens? And they peeled off their faces and revealed that they were reptiles. And so it was a 5-part miniseries, I think, it came out in, like, the late 80s. And it aired in primetime slot, like 7 p.m. on a Wednesday, which is when MacGyver was on, or Ally McBeal, or whatever it was. And then suddenly it moved to an 11 p.m. slot where it just ran. It disappeared off air for like 2 weeks. And then suddenly the last three episodes ran like 3 nights in a row at 11 p.m. And my mom was very kind and recorded it for me on VCR. But I was a kid, and I said to her, I was like, why, what's happened here? And she said, look, it's because they had freedom fighters. And obviously, you know, that's what the ANC government were, or not the ANC freedom fighters, before they became the ANC government, were called freedom fighters. And that's why it was banned. And I went digging on this a couple of years later because I wanted to give a talk about it, and it was much worse than that. So an old school journalist friend of mine was like, oh, no, I covered it. What happened was the second last apartheid president, his nickname was Die Groot Krokodil, which means the big crocodile. And he was so vain, he thought the show was about him. He thought it was actual American propaganda, that the fact that they revealed themselves as reptiles was American propaganda specifically designed to destabilize the South African state. So science fiction has power, you guys.
It worked. Did you ever catch up on Amethyst?
No. I tried to read the reboot, but it was terrible. And it starts with a rape. I was like, really?
Emma. on the predictive power of science fiction.
And how much responsibility you feel towards that.
Yeah.
Especially writing about climate change. Can you solve climate change?
The question you always dread. No, I think it's like you said, you know, you extrapolate with science fiction. You can take an idea and you can kind of, like, look at different possibilities that it could produce, and that's kind of the fun of it. But also I like the fact that you can sometimes think about angles that aren't necessarily talked about. So just as an example, in The Coral Bones, I wanted to explore the idea of solar geoengineering, which is talked about a lot as a potential kind of, you know, big fix and stuff. And, oh, we could pump all these sulfides into the air and we can mimic a volcano and everything. And yes, the temperature's cool, but I was like, but what would it be like to live under a white sky for 20 years? You know, what would that do to you? That's the sort of question that I like to sort of ask about those things. So it's not necessarily about predicting it as such as sort of saying, well, if this thing did happen, what would it look like? And what would it actually mean to be on the ground and to experience that? What would that do to you as a society, as an individual? So, but I think that can also work in a more positive way as well, because we're used to sort of thinking about these ideas in a very dystopian way, but you can also use science fiction to show how technology could be used for the good. So, yeah.
I'd like to pick up on something you said. So I read literally thousands of stories in compiling this. And it did seem that there were stories about the future where they were really, really, the author was very invested in the detail of how the future works. And then there were lots of stories as well that, and you say it better than I ever would, annoyingly, now that we're post-publication, but, you know, what it meant, you know, not the detail of the thing that happened, but actually what it means that that thing happened and what would it feel like for a person. When you are setting out to write a future, how do you go about the balance of, you know, here's the how, but then here's the what does that make me feel? The detail versus the vibes, as the kids would say.
I think I'm much more into vibes. You know, Zoo City, which won the Arthur C. Clarke Award, like, I don't care where the magical animals come from. I don't care what the undertow is. You know, I think we have so many unanswered questions about our lived reality. What happens after we die? I don't know. So there's some theories in the book, but I don't have a specific answer. And it's interesting when you start looking at adapting work or screen and TV. So I had a horror short story, and the producers kept coming back, and they were like, but what is this haunted book? What does it do? Where does it come from? I'm like, who cares? Who cares where the monkey's paw comes from? It is about the impact it has on humans. And what I'm interested in looking at is kind of that human aspect. I do think genre can be really interesting, like getting around big issues in a really interesting way, because you get over issue fatigue. So I think a lot of people are like, it's exhausting to talk about climate change, but to like live through a world where it's not ours, where we're not facing, you know, what I think Cory Doctorow has very memorably called enshittification, which is our current dystopia, which is awful. Where you can live in an entirely, where they have some similar issues, but you're in a different imagined space. It gives you the freedom to like feel that in a different way and to engage with it in a different way. And I think that's very helpful in the thinking. But you had a great, you said last year you were on a climate change panel and they were like, well, how do we solve climate change? But actually one of the other panelists had a great answer. And maybe...
Yeah, her answer is, which she put much better than I would, and I'm going to steal it for the future. But I think it's true, is that books are there to ask questions, not to necessarily to give answers. They might be there to pose ideas and stuff, but really I think of our job as writers is to ask the questions, because I'm certainly not qualified to give the answers. But yeah, no, I think I come down on the vibe side as well, probably. But and it's not that this kind of technical stuff isn't interesting; often it is. But I think for me, what drives me to write about these things is how people feel about it. What does it mean to know that you've got a body waiting for you and you're going to wake up in it the next morning? How do you feel about that body? Do you resent it? Do you love it? Do you hate it? Do you fear it? Do all of those things together? And that's what I find really, really interesting about it. Yeah.
I tend to agree. And you will see the thousands of stories turned into a sort of 100 stories about vibes. But, even linking it back to Neuromancer, the sort of seminal cyberpunk novel, it's aged really well because it is absolutely crap when it comes to the detail of the tech. And everyone thinks, oh, you know, this is great. It's just out of Neuromancer. Like, the detail of the technology is incredibly poor, but the vibes are quite strong. You know what it feels like to use these things, even if you don't know what the things themselves are or how they work. But I would like to... I don't know why I'm shilling Neuromancer. Neuromancer's fine. We don't need to talk about that much. But I would like to talk about that. Moral obligation is a terrible way of putting this. But let's just sort of agree as a panel that reality kind of sucks right now.
Mm-hmm.
So why the impulse to then write about kind of sucky futures? Like, is that... Why are we asking these questions? Because we're already living in the suck. The enshittification, I think, is a nicer term for it. Not nicer. More accurate term. So why write about bleak futures?
Well, I don't really anymore, but I think I'm just trying to, get at like what it means to be a person in the world right now. And I think, you know, the issues that I'm dealing with in my work is kind of interrogating reality right now and dealing with the enshittification, dealing with prejudice and war and, you know, right-wing crazy people getting into power. I think it's a form of hope is writing through it, maybe. I also think, as a South African, having come from a very traumatized society, you know, that's absolutely the perspective I bring to the work. I lived through, I'm jumping ahead because I know one of your questions is, like, what's your favorite, like, kind of future story? And I think it's Omelas, where the entire city, this wonderful utopia, is built on one child suffering terribly in the dark. And I lived that utopia, you know, so I think as a white South African, growing up in a country that was built for me, with all the privileges. And I think I'm very aware of that kind of social justice aspect. And I think, you know, South Africans have a very dark sense of humor as a way of dealing with things. And I think it is the imaginative leap to, like, how do you find the humanity? And I think that is the thing. It's like, not like, guys, look how fucked up everything is. It's how do you still find your humanity? How do you still find hope? How do you still find a way through this? And to recognize that essential human quality.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think you're trying to sort of find a, not necessarily a way out, but a way through, I think is a really good way to put it. It's like we all know what we're living through and the brutalities that entails. And perhaps by looking at the near future, you're sort of trying to steer that path a little bit. And I think perhaps you mentioned you're not writing so much bleak dystopia anymore. I feel the same. And I think although The Coral Bones does have a sort of future section that in some ways has a really, you know, there's a huge amount of loss, there's biodiversity loss, there's habitat loss, there's a lot of places that no one can live anymore. But it was really important to me that the characters in that stage of the novel were acting positively and proactively, and they're trying to restore nature. They have, you know, the society itself has kind of moved on in the way we connect to each other and the way we connect to non-human animals. So I think you can kind of show both sometimes. You can show a future that is degraded in some way, but also that people have kind of evolved and learned as a society as well. So I guess that's maybe a bit more where my work's going now.
I think that's really interesting. And you've also hit on the theme of agency and challenge and, you know, the punk part of this. You know, that is a very sort of, it's not really gentle punk when it's people against a collapsing world or a recovering world, but that idea of personal agency is, I think, incredibly core. And runs through your works as well. And I mean, there's always people that are, every one of your books, there's someone that is actually fighting against some sort of systemic or personal or interpersonal sort of oppression, but actually figuring out a way to reclaim that power for themselves.
Yeah, and I think, again, that comes from the South African perspective, you know, and that's, and I think that global South perspective is, like, really important in the world right now, you know, and I think about, like, South Africa bringing the case to the International Court of Justice, and, you know, I feel like we have a very particular understanding of the world. And I know as a white South African, that's different to, like, a black South African's understanding, but you have a real sense of injustice, and if you look at climate change in particular, it is going to be the global south which is going to be, like, disproportionately affected. And all the problems that people are upset about now, like people coming to this country because their countries are falling apart, are just going to get much, much worse. What I'm interested in is not just the forward, it's also the backwards, because that is a history of colonialism. You know, these countries are destroyed because of colonialism. So it is that kind of tug between the past and the present, and I think we can't forget about that either. And in looking to the future, we actually need to really acknowledge, like, the past as well and examine it and explore it and kind of and also, you know, think about, like, what to do and how to work through it. But I do think the human experience is hopeful. I think we're also living through a time of great grief. And I think it's also important to, like, feel that. But I think generally as a species we're hopeful. I mean, whether that's genetic coding, fine. And I think storytelling is a really important way to engage with that and to engage with other people and other minds and other experiences. Even if they're fictionalized, I'm engaging. If I'm reading your writing, I'm engaging with you and these worlds that you have imagined, and that's really interesting.
I think one of the, so we've looked at sort of a few dimensions that are sort of definitely by intent. Very much we've talked about the sort of, like, not that bleak but bleakish future, the, you know, the sense of agency and challenge. And then one of the other things, vibes, not details. And then one of the other things that's always struck me about cyberpunk is it's little science fiction. That is a terrible way of putting it, but, you know, if
it's not spaceships, it's not colonizing.
Well, if it is spaceships, it's actually about the playlist that you're listening to, as opposed to, you know, the faster than light drive. And I'm trying to phrase this in a way that doesn't sound incredibly derogatory, because your books are incredibly powerful and your stories are. But, you know, Alligator Heap is a story about a strawberry, and The Coral Bones is a story about a seahorse, and it grows from there. But it's finding hope in these little things. Does it start from there? Do you think, like, here is, you know, one small thing, what does that mean? Or does it, I have this huge problem, this huge theme that I need to do, you know, how can I best distill it into something that I can hold in the palm of my hand?
I think often the little things are that kind of core that you can kind of pull out from, I guess. But I think, you know, you look at any one thing and it comes back to that kind of sense of connectivity, the fact that, you know, in anything, however small as a strawberry, it's so intricate and perfect, and the more you look at it, the more there is to kind of, you know, see in it. And I guess that becomes, in a sense, especially perhaps when you're talking about climate change and connectivity and thinking about our relationship to the more than human world, I think having something like that to focus on actually is a sort of starting point in a way. Especially the leafy sea dragon, which is just so extraordinarily intricate when you look at that and you think, how did that even evolve, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
And you do connect it from the past all the way through to the future, which is...
Yeah. But nice, I think also when you've got a really big... If you're trying to do something on a big canvas, like with the Coral Bones, I had past, present and future, you kind of need something to anchor it, I guess, as well, and that sort of symbolism in some ways that, that holds the story together.
I have been deliberately avoiding the term dystopian because I'm just academic enough to really dislike the definition, because dystopians are static, just like utopias are supposed to be static, and a dystopia is static. And I think in cyberpunk and in Omelas and in some of these other, you know, they inherent to it is actually the idea of challenge, that maybe we can actually change it if we choose to. So we are going to stick with the incredibly detailed term sucky reality. And you spoke a bit about Omelas, but Emma, do you have a favorite sucky reality story?
Oh, I was thinking about this prior to the panel. I think someone who does, he might hate me for saying this, but I think someone who does sucky reality very well at the moment is Matt Hill, who is very good on a kind of austerity Britain, as it were, and it feels really, you know, gritty and grim and bleak at times, but he's also got an absolutely incredible imagination. His most recent book, Glam, which is really wonderful, has a kind of evolving mold, which does all sorts of weird stuff, but he's also got a real humanity at the heart of his books, and his, this book, Glam, is very much focused on parent-child relationships. So I think he combines that kind of sense of, you get a real sense of what it's like to live in Britain right now, but you also get this mad imagination and this very, very, you know, relationship-focused work at the same time. So I would give Matt a shout-out.
I have one to add. Which is the TV show Years and Years.
Oh, yes, that's a great example.
Oh, my God, except episode 4, I've had people phone me and shout at me for, like, because it's so harrowing, but that is absolutely Britain right now. The ending falls into hacking is magic, but up until the final episode, it is just a harrowing look at kind of influencer culture and, like, filters that we put on Instagram. It's with Emma Thompson, I think it takes place over 20 years. There's, like, a nuclear attack. There's, like, dealing with a refugee crisis. And I do want to use the word refugee rather than migrants, because I am a migrant. I moved to this country for more economic opportunity. I did not flee war. I did not flee horror. So, yeah, it's a wonderful TV show. But also, episode 4 will break you. It will absolutely break you.
Yeah, I would definitely.
I do not want angry emails, because I've warned you.
But one of the, like, editorial rules going into this is that no extracts. All the stories had to be standalone, self-contained stories that start and middle and end. But I actually read, while I was compiling this, I had a chance to read the first couple chapters of Lamb, of Matt Hill's Lamb, and they might be some of the most perfect cyberpunk sort of written. I think it's about a trucker as automated trucks come in and sort of facing his future and deal, you know, how is he going to go home and tell his families that he's about to be replaced. It's incredibly powerful. And then, you know, mold. But I'm so glad you mentioned it. It's such a powerful book.
I also want to mention, like, coming from a South African perspective, is that we, you know, we don't have a lot of, like, we've had to cobble tech together, you know, and, like, we've had to, like, deal with things in a really interesting way. You know, for example, I was a journalist for a long time, and I would cover pieces on, there was the University of Cape Town was trying to monitor tuberculosis. And the big problem with tuberculosis is that people have to take a regimen of like 12, up to 12 drugs a day to be able to manage it. And you've got very rural communities, and people aren't like well-educated. And, you know, for like someone like me to take 12 pills a day, I would struggle. You know, I would not be able to remember to do that. So what they did was they trained up peer counselors in the villages. And then they connected them with a very basic Nokia phone with a drop-down menu. And you could, so the peer counselors would go and check in on people and be like, what are your symptoms? How are you feeling today? And it was just a drop-down list. And then you'd send that back to the university. And the doctors at the university would like send back saying, like, sounds great, patient's doing great. Or actually, no, the patient needs to come in and we need to check in on this because this is a worrying thing. And like just that cobbling together and like trying to make solutions and trying to find things where it's not all like magical working internet everywhere, you know, that's also kind of where I'm coming from. And I think that's also a really interesting perspective to kind of play with, is janky technology which doesn't work, or people like subverting it or finding other ways around it.
I completely agree with that. And that it goes back to agency as well, and that sort of uniquely human problem solving that we bring to it, which is hopeful, even in a sucky reality story, watching people sort of, these fantasies of people managing to like cobble their way through is absolutely brilliant. Quick one. But while I'm sort of forcing you to do sales pitches, if someone enjoyed Alligator Heap, what full-sized E.J. Swift novels did they pick up next?
I guess because Alligator Heap has this sort of stratified society, it would make sense to recommend Osiris, which was my first book, which is set in a city. The city are cut off from the rest of the world. They do believe they're the last city on Earth, and they're very much a kind of city of the haves and have-nots, and you've got two characters from either side of the divide, both of whom are sort of chasing this slightly central mystery. So I would probably say Osiris for this particular story. But I guess Alligator Heap does have those kind of environmental kind of things woven in as well, in which case the Coral Bones would be the other one. So cheating by saying two. Yeah,
I was going to do the same.
You're not allowed to say Moxieland. So fine, and that, okay. The extrapolation of the story is...
Fine. I'm going to come back to the punk aesthetic. And I just want to add something, which is, I think, I read a beautiful quote earlier this year. It might have been from Charlie Jane Ander's newsletter, which is that hope is rage. And it is rage. It's not just like unfocused rage. It is rage that things don't have to be this way and we can change it. And I think tapping into that kind of that punk energy and that anger is actually ferociously important, especially in a society which is trying to numb us. It's like, well, we can't fix climate change, so we might as well give up. You know, that's what they want, you know, is to defang us. And if we want change, we're going to have to be angry. We're going to have to do things. But I think my most punk novel, because it's a little bit rough and ready, but also just, I think it's my favorite in many ways, is Zoo City, which won the Arthur C. Clarke Award. It's about a magical Johannesburg. I don't really understand why it won a science fiction prize, but fine. Where people, criminals have magical animals. So if you've committed a heinous crime, a magical animal manifests out of somewhere and attaches itself to you, and the heroine has a sloth on her back and the magical ability to find lost things, but she's so lost and broken and she's trying to find a way back to herself and gets involved in a noirish case around missing pop stars. It's weird, it's punk, it's absolutely Johannesburg. I was on a panel recently with Nnedi Okorafor in Finland, no, in Sweden, and the very sweet Nordic person who was interviewing us was like, oh, and it's such a beautiful dystopian Johannesburg. And I was like, no, 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 that's just Johannesburg. Like, I added magical animals, but the rest is verbatim. Like, what? And yeah, so I have a very strong attachment to Sioux City, and I think if we're talking about kind of more punk kind of works, and it's all, I think it's also quite hopeful and it's quite angry. We've also just re-recorded the audiobook. It's about a black South African woman. I did have an authenticity reader at the time when that was not done. I approached a novelist friend of mine. But we've just re-recorded the audiobook. The original was read by a white French Canadian, putting on a very bad Afrikaans accent for some reason. But the new audiobook, I handpicked the narrator, Clindiswa James. She's a young Xhosa woman, an incredible activist and actor in her own right and theater maker. And I live directed the audiobook from London, and she nails it. So if you have Spotify Premium, it's free on Spotify Premium, otherwise it's Audible. But if you want to hear it, as I imagine it, and in the most beautiful voice you've ever heard, go check out the audiobook.
It just occurs to me, it has a crocodile in it, not an alligator?
Yeah.
So we've really, that's our through line.
Yeah, no, we have.
Cyberpunk is mostly about alligators.
Absolutely.
And crocodiles.
It's a bit scaly. And also, we had a crocodile earlier, so, you know, we're just like...
They're everywhere.
Circle. Yeah.
So one... Last question for me. We've talked a bit about cyberpunk and talking about the near future and sort of its line looking forwards, but this is a genre that was sort of crystallized, at least in the 80s. You know, there were some predecessors to it, also in the book, but really it sort of, you know, the term was defined, the genre came into its own in the 80s. And there, you were not writing in the 80s, either of you.
Well,
And yes, only sort of stories about magical moving cats, probably. Mm. And I think that's sort of one of the core theses of the book is that this is a genre that is alive and thriving. But there is a note of nostalgia to it. And I do wonder, you know, Lauren, a lot of your books are actually set in sort of a near past. There's sort of an element of nostalgia to them. Thinking specifically Paris Adrift View, there's sort of a nostalgia element. But how does nostalgia and science fiction fit together? I mean, that's such a weird setting, but a weird pairing, but both of you have done it. Like, is there something we can learn from looking at the near past or something that inspires you about that?
I only recently, because I don't have like a proper formal education, I only recently found out about hauntology. So hauntology is, I think Mark Fisher has some beautiful YouTube videos on it, but it's basically our visions of the future were formed in the 50s. And Elon Musk, who unfortunately is a white South African man, is deeply embarrassing to me, but also classic. You know, when he's talking about colonizing Mars, that's from the 50s. Like, if we are still envisioning a future based on what we imagined in the 50s with Rosie the robot and like Mars colonies, we're screwed. We need to like break away from that entirely. We need to look at what's actually happening. We need to look at different voices and different perspectives and really kind of explore like a different future,
where we're not basing it on freaking something almost like a century ago.
You know, Mark Fisher is probably the key figure in British cyberpunk, as opposed to American cyberpunk, and that's such a huge part of it. That, you know, that ontology is key to what I argue is the story that started it all, which is the Gernsback Continuum, which is sort of Gibson's, like, holy shit, these, like, big single-wing aircrafts are not going to happen. What are we going to do? And I think that's such an important point. It is about wrestling with nostalgia in that way and actually trying to find a new future.
I don't want to hog this, but I just want to, I think that there is nostalgia because nostalgia is mourning. We're mourning the loss of something, and we're mourning the loss of way of life, and, like, things have changed so fast. I think cyberpunk is essentially, like, it is a reaction to this onslaught of modernity that we cannot possibly, we've not been evolved to keep up with this. And the fact that we're now addicted to dopamine-feeding algorithms that control us, and it's awful. But we should be angry and not looking to the 1950s for solutions.
100%. I think nostalgia is, I suppose, it's something you have to kind of battle against in a way when you're writing, because it's so easy to kind of fall into that sort of sense and let that somehow imprint on the future that you're creating as well. I'm discussing with someone the other day who was sort of saying, the 90s, the best era and stuff. And it's like, well, for many people growing up at that time in our, you know, in the UK at that time, for some people, that was a great time, but it wasn't for everyone. And it's that sort of rose-tinted view of, it was Britpop, it was great. As well as, like, yeah, but for most people, that wasn't the experience. So I think it's sort of trying to somehow detach your nostalgia and your experience in some ways to when you're thinking about the future and not let that kind of bleed into what you're trying to create, which I guess ties into what you're saying about embracing these different perspectives and trying to find new ways of looking at things. So I guess I see that as, that's kind of a challenge, really. Mm.
Last question, and then I'm going to hand it over. So please do formulate your thoughts.
Or apparently the match scores.
Yes, it will match scores. My T-shirt, agree or disagree?
I hated your T-shirt when I saw it earlier. I was mad with you.
It's deliberately provocative.
I know. But I do feel like we've let... I say we've let. I don't know how much agency we actually have. You know, I don't think this country has a democracy necessarily, just because of the way you don't have proportional representation. I don't understand how we were supposed to fight it. But I feel like, you know, we basically become... Our entire future and the entire present is dependent on what the shareholders want for maximum profits. And it buys out politicians, it buys out our future. You have a kid, you know, you're thinking about, like, how most of things are going to be for them, and it's just really frustrating. So I feel like we deserve it in the fact that we haven't fought against it, but I don't know how we're supposed to fight against it. I don't understand how we're supposed to fight against it. And that feels very disempowering. So maybe writing fiction allows me to have a sense of agency and control, which I can't have in the real world. Short of, you know, quitting my day job and becoming a politician or an activist or, I don't know.
Please don't. I like you too much.
I think this ties into my sort of eternal debate as to whether I have faith in humanity generally doing the right thing or generally doing the wrong thing. So, which changes from day to day.
How do you feel today?
Well, I feel like we're having sort of positive conversation today. So today I'm feeling generally good about humanity.
Give it a week.
Give it a week, yeah.
Half an hour at most.
Thank you both very much. I'd like to turn it over here. Please, questions. And there are microphones.
Corporations having so much power and branding. Mm. I was thinking about Paolo can't remember his surname. I wrote a book called The Wind Up Girl about sort of a future Thailand where corporations have stopped seeds from being able to be germinated without their special biotech. Mm-hmm. One, do you worry about this and that's going to become a reality? And sort of two, do you feel a responsibility as writers to warn people about that?
I don't expect either of you to be experts on sort of like biobot.
I mean, Monsanto already does that, right?
They do, don't they?
Yeah.
But I love that idea. As writers, if you see something, if you have this vision, if you have this horrifying vision or warning of the future, do you have a responsibility to tell us about it?
I don't have, no. What am I supposed to
do?
Share
all of your darkest fears.
No, actually, totally, no. I mean, I do share all my darkest fears. You know, I talk about my books being my psychology, you know, and I think that people respond to them because I'm talking about stuff that we're all feeling. But I don't, you know, as you said, we don't have the solutions. Like, it is our job to ask questions, but maybe you get someone to feel something, or maybe you get someone to engage with an idea in a way that maybe they hadn't thought of before. Maybe it's just the way that makes them feel. It's not at all cyberpunk, and it's got nothing to do with the future, but like The Shining Girls is a book about a time-traveling serial killer, and I specifically wanted to write about violence against women, and how it affects us as a society, how we talk about it, and also to center like the victims. So it's not just, you know, a pretty dead girl or like the horror of what was done to her. It was like, this is a sense of the person that we've lost. And it's happened a handful of times where I've had people come up to me, usually privately, like at the end of a session or like, you know, once in a bar and an email, and say, something happened to me and the way you wrote about it was right. And I think that's what you're trying to get at, is like the truth of how we feel about things and what it means to be a person in this cascade of modernity where everything is terrifying and we feel helpless. And maybe it's just that I think if we have any kind of responsibility, it's a responsibility to tell each other stories and to communicate who we are and to bring all of who we are to the book on both sides. Because the way you are going to read a book is going to be different to the way you are going to read a book because you are bringing who you are to the page.
You can't do everything, you can't respond to everything, but the things you do choose to focus on, you have a responsibility to do right by and to do to the best of your ability, I guess. If I sort of uncovered some kind of thing that I didn't think was widely known, and I don't know how I'd feel about that, whether I'd feel that was up to me or someone else to reveal, but yeah, I think, yeah, you feel that responsibility to take your subject material seriously, as you say, and to do right by it.
And I think fiction gives people a different way of engaging with things. Mm.
I think that's a really good point. And that's been a theme through the, at least from what I've seen of the festival over the past 2 days. I mean, it raises questions, not answers. It's a place for questions, not answers. And it's a place about the role of people. And I don't know why I'm shilling the Bradford Literature Festival to people actually at the hood, but it just sort of reinforces the importance of spaces like this where discussions can happen and why they're so precious to us.
I had a question about if you had any favourite examples around how people respond to their sucky reality. And if you don't mind, I'll give you a kind of quick example that I've noticed. So I work for one of those big 100,000-person corporates, and internally we don't use any automated systems to screen job applications, but people externally don't know that. Mm. So what I've seen is that when an internal applicant applies for a job, that you get a normal CV, they talk about what they did. An external applicant, there's sort of like the human readable part of the CV, and then there's this mass of keywords that's clearly designed not for humans, but for whatever automated system to pick up the right keyword. And I thought that was a really interesting example of how people have essentially, we've created more work for people in order to respond to a machine, right? So yeah, wonder if you had any examples.
Well, I think AI, like literally destroying the cultural industry, is probably a pretty solid thing. Plagiarism engines are just like reaping work, or giant tech companies that are profiting off them, using more electricity than anything else, including freaking Bitcoin mining. So it's great that we've stopped using plastic straws, but vapes are a big thing, and AI is like, turn off your air conditioner, save the planet. No, AI is like going to destroy everything, and it's a confabulation engine giving people the wrong answers and dangerous answers. And, I work in a shared studio space with about 40 illustrators and animators and designers and artists. Their work has dried up. And what art is going to be, and some people are getting paid to fix AI stuff and being paid much less than they would be normally. And I came up as a journalist doing crappy journalism, like on best small conference venues in Cape Town, and then also some cool hard-hitting stories. But it was the shit ones which paid for me to work, and it paid for me to develop my voice and to grow as a writer. And what we're going to see happen is that we're going to have more people. Art is going to become the preserve of the very rich. It's already very difficult to make a living as a writer. I think the median book advance is like £12,000. And like, if you think about how long it takes you to write a book, people are living off trust funds or their day jobs or a spouse. It's very hard to make it as an author, and it's just going to become harder. And you could say, oh, well, people are going to care about work made by humans. I'm like, yeah, great. Like the same way we care about tailoring versus buying Shein products. It's yes, there will still be some of that, but not in the mass market. The mass market doesn't care. And I think government has to fight really hard right now. And that is one thing that I'm seeing, which I'm really afraid of. And I am speaking out about it, but I'm not writing fiction about it. I'm doing panels and I'm doing like talks about AI.
I want to ask a question about where cyberpunk starts and where it ends, because obviously there's a strong aesthetic component to cyberpunk, but then there's also like a sort of thematic component to it. And obviously it's rooted in the 70s and 80s. So would something written like now about today's topics, about corporate overreach and dystopias, which is still happening now, worth writing about, is that still cyberpunk? And is there a post-cyberpunk, essentially? Will we come up with a new term, and that will be a new branch of sci-fi, essentially? Yeah.
That is a banging question. Thank you.
I've wrote a book, and I don't know if it's cyberpunk or not, essentially.
The issue with cyberpunk is that it is both it's a science fiction field, a sort of a literary field, I suppose, and it's also it's got its own academic field. And that is two groups of people that will never agree on any definition ever. So my thinking personally is very much like yours. And I think it's genuinely fascinating because it didn't exist. There's all sorts of predecessors. And then in 1984, someone uses the word Bruce Bethke, you know, an editor jumps on that and is like, yes, this is the movement we are seeing now. All of a sudden, people sort of grab everything together. Within a year, Bruce Sterling, who essentially was one of the founders of the genre, goes, it's fucking dead. You're like, oh my God, thanks, Bruce. That's great. You know, so there is a sort of like really strict interpretation of cyberpunk that where it lasted for about 16 months. But then at the same time, you have Blade Runner. And that, you know, the world it describes and the world it paints is exactly what some of the cyberpunks were thinking, only they weren't thinking that. And they're like, oh, that's actually... And if you look at cyberpunk now, you've got Janelle Monáe. You have a cyberpunk extension to Fortnite. You have, you know, people, actually, Janelle Monáe is a terrible example because she is actually properly thematically cyberpunk, but the aesthetic of cyberpunk, that sort of 80s rain and neon and trench coats and fake kanji characters, like, that has long outlived the original literary properties, but then, at the same time, you've got this theme of what Emma and Lauren have expressed really well of people and challenge and humanity in the face of modernity, like, that has continued really solidly. But it's also been adopted by other literature. So, in conclusion, I would call it cyberpunk, because I think the theme is the most important thing. But there is a huge school of thought where people will be like, it's not really cyberpunk unless there's, like, rain and really breasty androids on the cover. So, both of which I genuinely are valid interpretations of cyberpunk. But good luck arguing with the publisher or the platform on how you make that happen.
It's like an irony in cyberpunk that, as you say, it's in Fortnite now, where essentially the corporations have co-opted cyberpunk.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it's almost, do we have to move on, essentially? I mean, because it's been co-opted now, so it's yeah.
But everything's been co-opted.
But I do love, you know, people are like, look, Elon Musk is doing brain implants. That's so cool. This is the future we want. Like, that is cyberpunk, guys, is when you were letting a billionaire put, you know, electric tapeworms in your head.
That's, yeah, when his car is like catch on fire.
Yeah. So you've been very patient. So
I was going to ask a bit about narrative power and where it is at different points, because you brought up the 50s and this whole thing. And I work in essentially responses to climate change. And to me, I keep looking back to that post-war period, particularly from a UK perspective of, we had the welfare state and the NHS and a load of really cool stuff about planning, which I bore people with for hours, but you know, I work in that area. Narratives were kind of giving positive change. I weirdly feel like cyberpunk, it was like all those things that like, oh, you know, cyberpunk dystopias have all this terrible stuff, but it's like, which is now becoming reality.
But in a really boring way.
Yeah. How do we get back to the kind of powerful narratives that can give positive change? I don't think cyberpunk is responsible for it becoming reality, but certainly people like Elon Musk who kind of like, oh yeah, that sounds really good.
And I think he also quotes Ian M. Banks as being like one of his favorite authors or something. And it's like, did you miss everything? But the point is, what you're talking about socialism. You're talking about the NHS. You're talking about human solutions. You're not talking about the tech. And I think that is what we need to re-engage with, is our shared humanity.
One thing we're really lacking at the moment is those kind of positive stories, those heroes, those things to engage with that aren't a sort of petrol-fueled future. You know, we need something alternative to the car driving down the highway with the, you know, the windows down and the... Well, maybe we do have the car, but it's an electric car. But, you know, we need something like that. We need something really powerful. We need
bicycles.
Powerful images, powerful stories.
Yeah, bicycles.
Every
bicycles.
Zombie apocalypse, where are the bicycles? I don't understand.
Yeah. I think that's where storytelling can be really powerful, and there can be, you know, a role for writers and artists and creators to play in creating those new narratives and those new visions and that more hopeful, this positive future that we would like to all believe in. It doesn't have to be something that comes with loss, actually. It's something where we all gain something. And I think that's the stories we don't necessarily have at the moment.
In defense of cyberpunk. No, I think one of the things that is really important that we touched on is that there's no static future in cyberpunk. They, you know, if you look at don't want to spoil the end of Neuromancer if you haven't read it. Its 40th anniversary is tomorrow. But it has an incredibly hopeful ending. Like, it's incredibly positive, incredibly sweet, actually, and a bit romantic. And people sort of forget that, just as they also forget that they're actually, like, talking voodoo gods in it. But, you know, there's a lot going on there. And all of the original cyberpunk works, and in fact, all the streams of them are, it's about that lack of stasis. You know, there are cyberpunk works that are actually about what look like utopias, but actually people are, you know, there's some sort of flaw in the system that actually breaks it apart. And then there's quite a few that look like dystopias, but actually there are humans as agents of change. And it gives you a bit of hope that, you know, maybe this house or this neighborhood or this person or this world is going to change. And I agree. I think, you know, it'd be wonderful to have the big sweeping narrative that would galvanize us again. But I'm not sure. Maybe we're just too jaded as a society to ever buy one right now that's 100% positive. We need something that is going to be rooted in that sort of grim realism, I suppose.
To come back to South Africa the last time, we got to reboot our entire constitution. We got to start from scratch. We got to sit down as a country and be like, you know what? That stuff was garbage. It wasn't working. We were the fifth country in the world to ratify gay marriage. France recently claimed to say that they were like, we're the first country to like entrench the right to abortion in the constitution. It's like, oh, no, we did that in 1996. So there is hope and there can be change, but there needs to be the political will and there needs to be the will of the people. And sometimes there needs to be violent revolution. And I think we do need to tap into that anger and I think we do need to find solutions. I don't know how, but yeah.
Did not expect this to end in a call for violent revolution. Oh, we're not being invited back, are we?
I haven't set anything on fire yet.
I think we have time for one last question.
I wanted to pull in a Venn diagram of two things that you mentioned today, and one is hope is rage, and rage initiates action, whether or not it's necessarily comfortable for others to experience. And then the other is that cyberpunk and dystopian fiction, sci-fi in general, is a lens to look at what's happening today through like a retro nostalgia by looking forward. And thinking about the timeline of the types of books we've had since its genesis officially in the 80s and going forward, in previous sort of iterations of sci-fi, there's normally like an othering element. So Under the Shadow of the Cold War, Invasion through the guise of aliens, the allegory is quite thin. It was always an outside coming in. Thinking about the works that you're writing about and what you talked about now, it's about the center of the self of your own society collapsing before you rather than having that change forced upon you. You know, you're not being invaded by aliens. It's not someone coming in from the cold as a spy. It's your society crumbling beneath your feet, and how do you respond to that? And I was just really curious, when you're thinking about how you write those kinds of things, which strands of the here and now are you pulling forward to ground whatever sort of slightly alternate future you're building? Because that's the rug that you pull out from under people's feet. So from a technical story point of view, you obviously have those igniting touch points with the big picture, but how do you choose those small things that really either force your reader to understand how different their world is, or how what threads are actually staying the same and what's constant, and therefore making everything else alien by contrast? So from a like a writing technical point of view, I'd be really interested.
That's a fantastic question. Can I get the mic here, and so we can cram your question in. Actually, will you ask as well, and we'll answer them both together.
Well, it's a really quick one. It's just used a word, somethingification, earlier.
Oh, inshitification. Shit.
Inshitification.
Sorry.
Yeah, I get it now. Thank you. That's all I wanted to... No okay. Explanation.
So, we are out of time, I think. So let's answer the.
But you can ask us outside.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to be right outside.
I'm sorry, that was such a beautiful question. You're going to hate my answer. Gut instinct, like what feels right. I just kind of feel my way through.
Yeah, I think it's sort of trying to work out which things maybe sit together and that you can't consider separately. So, like, I think with climate change, it's like, well, you can't think about climate change in the future without thinking about social justice as well, for example. And that's why I sort of wanted the historical section in there as well, so that I had that kind of line through and into the future.
So intersectionalities.
And I guess, yeah, that's the proper word for it. Yeah, I, as you say, a lot of it is instinct and sort of just.
I think it's also the stuff which makes me angry. The stuff I feel like I'm like I'm really mad about this, or like I'm feeling like the pain of this, and yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about where turning points could be. I guess, like, especially if you're reaching forward, where what could make a difference in the future you want to create or that you're trying to imagine. Yeah, sorry, not to be more specific.
But it also sounds like you're both writing stuff, and it sounds really exciting. So please go and finish writing those things.
I do think your point on the cyberpunk as sort of very personal SF is a really interesting one as well. Mm. There's a, you know, with, you're in the 80s, you've got the big tech boom, you've got stuff changing, and you did have a generation of authors thinking, okay, but what does that mean to me and my fluid identity and how I want to be and how I want to change or be reflected or have the world acknowledge that? And there's some absolutely wonderfully powerful stories that came out of that that were wildly progressive in a genre that was not doing a great job on that. But it was sort of very encouraging to see that. Again, in studying this, it was absolutely fascinating reading even Omni, classic science fiction magazine title. There was a moment in 1984 where it changed editors, and all of a sudden it went from like Sex Slaves of the Lizard Goddess to, you know, William Gibson and Nancy Kress and all of these incredible authors who were pushing boundaries in new ways. And you're like, oh, thank God. Like, this is, it's nice to see this. Talk about turning points. In that case, it was Ellen Datlow picking up the pen, but it was an amazing moment. Thank you all very much, and thank you to our wonderful panelists.
And thanks for putting together such a great anthology.
You're very welcome.
Two such great anthologies.
No, just one, for rights reasons.
Yeah, sorry. But there are two books.
But if we could give them a big round of applause.
Thank you for listening. The 2025 Bradford Literature Festival starts on the 27th of June with a huge programme of events, from comedy to crime, music to memoirs. Head to bradfordlitfest.co.uk to book your ticket now.